every one of you listening to my voice, tell the world, tell this to everybody wherever they are. Watch the skies everywhere. Keep looking. Keep watching the skies.
I'm Andrea Johnson, and you're listening to Retro Rockets. Join us as we explore the deep heritage of science fiction and fantasy, yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Welcome aboard. Welcome to the show, Chris. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi. Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm a freelance writer. I've been working for roughly a decade. I've written for Den of Geek, for various tabletop games, including Spire, the City Must Fall. And I'm also the author of the official Doctor Who joke book. And most recently, I've brought out the paperback edition of my novella series, Fermi's Progress.
I'm going to be picking your brain a little bit later about that novella series. But first, I want to chit-chat about some things you and I have been talking about over Twitter, over email. We were talking about the evolution of Planet of the Week stories, and this is such a gigantic and such a fun topic. I don't know where to start with all of this. So you're one of the experts in this. Where should we start?
I think when we think Planet of the Week stories, the first example that jumps to everyone's mind is probably the original Star Trek series, isn't it? Just this idea of planet exploration as a procedural, where a mysterious alien planet is to the characters what a complex locked room murder mystery is to a detective, or mysterious diseases if you've got a medical character. So you have your protagonist heroes, but the star of these stories is very much the world that they're exploring.
It's almost it almost reminds me of a old-fashioned police procedural, a mystery, but it isn't a murder mystery. It's a we need to learn about a new planet or a new culture, or decide is this a threat to us, or is this planet friendly?
Exactly, and it feels to me like in many ways just it's the purest sci-fi fantasy, really, isn't it? Is that idea of just landing on a planet, getting out of your ship and seeing what's there.
You got to be pretty brave to just land on a planet that you've never been to. You have no idea what's there. And you say, hey, let's just walk out of this spaceship and see what greets us. Like, I don't know if that person is brave or absolutely crazy.
Yeah, and I think that brings us to, I think, the procedural part, because it's also about how do you take the unknown and make it routine? Because you've got, at the opposite end of the spectrum from Star Trek, you've obviously got Doctor Who, where they're basically just tourists bumming around, and they do just walk out of the TARDIS and straight into whatever the disaster of that week is. Well, with Star Trek and things like it, this is their job. There are procedures for if the ground turns out to be made entirely of tentacles with teeth.
Tentacles with teeth, that's terrifying. But it's, I like how you put that, where especially on Star Trek, it is literally their job. And, any scientist, any explorer, that's literally their job, because they want to learn new science and they want to go to new places.
Yeah, and I think one of the nice things about when you're sort of watching old Star Trek The Next Generation episodes, you'll have a crew member say, this strange mysterious light came and visited in my room came and visited me in my room last night. And people's reaction isn't, you know, to assume that they're having some sort of hallucination. It's always immediately, well, we're going to take this extremely seriously and at face value. And that just sort of the unknown as routine, I think, is very interesting from a story perspective.
I grew up watching Star Trek The Next Generation. I have so many happy memories of being, you know, 9, 10, 11 years old and watching that show with my dad. And it's so interesting that you say, take the unknown and make it routine. I grew up on that. And I've got to say, I think that really helped me as an adult because I was already used to that it's okay to take the unknown and make it routine.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, another, you know, to step slightly outside of our wheelhouse here, another procedural from the time, although we don't really think of it that way, is Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Oh, where, yes.
You know, you have maybe the first couple of episodes, everyone is freaking out, but by the third episode of the first season, you know, they have it down. Monster turns up, read the books, follow people around. They have a procedure for encountering bizarre paranormal things from wherever. And that sense that you can have a procedure, which is ultimately, in Star Trek, it's science. It's you find out what it is, what its limitations are, and how you can interact with it.
That's such a great parallel between like a paranormal procedurals like Buffy the Vampire Slayer or Ghost Hunters, anything paranormal, and exactly what's happening in Star Trek of let's figure out what this is, let's try some things, let's see if we can communicate with it, let's see what its boundaries are. And I never realized that until exactly this moment, all of those parallels.
But it's also, I think, it's a great way of picking up an idea and playing with it as well. Mm-hmm. Have you been watching the new Star Trek series, the Strange New Worlds one?
I've not. I've seen Discovery, I've seen some of Picard, and that's all I've seen so far.
Well, Strange New Worlds very much goes right back to being, you know, Star Trek in that old mold of very episodic story of the week type narration. And without wanting to give anything away, there is one episode where they have pretty much completely just lifted the entire plot of a famous work of dystopian sci-fi and just, that's the story. They make that a planet, the Enterprise comes to that planet, and that's the entire episode, is them encountering what is encountered in that story. And it's just a really good way of examining an idea, just landing on a planet, encountering it, turning it over, seeing what happens with it, and then moving on to another thing.
Do they at least credit that original story in the show credits?
No, to be fair, but it's to the point where the idea is lifted so completely obviously, and it's such an obvious homage, I'm not sure that it even counts as plagiarism, because it is just, it is clearly done with love. And it is
okay.
Clearly knows where it's coming from. Others may feel differently about that one, but it is very clearly an adaptation or an homage to this particular story. It just shows, I think, I'm a big fan of sort of short Twilight Zone-y type science fiction where you pick up an idea and run with it. And Planet of the Week is just a very good format for doing that, for examining the idea for a short amount of time, and then moving on from it.
It does sound like the perfect idea for a 30-minute episode of TV or a short story. What I mean by that is not something, it's not a literary or a story idea that can sustain itself over a very, very long time. It's designed to be short and sweet.
Yeah, I think, to go into a bit of old TV history a bit, mm-hmm. Lucille Ball of I Love Lucy was mm-hmm. behind the sort of financing of the original Star Trek pilot. And she was also instrumental in the making of the Twilight Zone pilot.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, it's not something that gets shouted out about a lot, but in the original Twilight Zone pilot, it was actually her husband doing the Rod Serling bit of the opening and closing narration of it. And I think it's not a coincidence that Star Trek came around almost exactly around the same time that Twilight Zone came to an end, because it was essentially a way of doing the Twilight Zone format, but with a recurring cast and recurring sets that you could reuse every week.
That is interesting that with Twilight Zone and shows of that type, they were 100% episodic. There was no connection at all between almost what we would call today a television anthology series, where there's no connection. And once you translate that into Star Trek, the characters are the same, the sets are the same. People can begin to build character arcs across episodes and through seasons, even though it is episodic storytelling.
Absolutely. And the big sort of key to Star Trek success was syndication. So the episodes were being broadcast all over the place. Sometimes they were out of order, sometimes they were jumbled up. In the original series, there are very few references to anything that ever happens before. I think it might just be the very final episode that there's ever a direct reference to something that has happened previously. And there is this evolution, which Star Trek is a brilliant barometer for, of going from that syndicated, extremely episodic storytelling to having characters who develop over time to reaching Deep Space Nine and reaching for almost fully serialized storytelling, which is...
You had said something so fascinating to me in one of our early conversations about Deep Space Nine, where it was the first Star Trek series where people were stuck there. They couldn't escape the consequences of their decisions.
Exactly. Which, on the one hand, is fantastic for TV budgets. And on the other hand, it allows you to tell stories that you can't tell when you're flying off at the end of each episode.
And it kind of flipped the Planet of the Week story. It flipped that script because the characters lived on Deep Space Nine. They weren't going anywhere, but the problems came to them.
Exactly. And we see that sort of being built on in Babylon 5, which came out around about the same time, as we go into Battlestar Galactica and Firefly. And eventually, when we get to Star Trek Discovery, this very long-term serialized form of storytelling becomes the norm. And we've gained so much from that, but at the same time, you kind of lose that sense of getting a fresh idea in each week, a fresh setting each week, strange new world each week. And we've seen, again, I think this is to do with streaming, we've seen anthologies come back in full force with Black Mirror, with the new Twilight Zone, with Love, Death and Robots. There's been a ton of anthologies. And I think it's not a coincidence that after we've had this wave of serialized drama and this wave of anthologies that we're now starting to get, not just Star Trek Strange New Worlds, but also things like The Mandalorian, where you have these ride into town, have an adventure, ride out of town again stories.
Mm-hmm. I remember having to explain to someone about Love, Death, and Robots, and I'm a huge fan of that show, having to explain to somebody, you don't have to watch the episodes in order. You can watch them in any order you want. They're not related to each other. And we were kind of exploring the show on Netflix, and the person I was talking to was just shocked by that of, you know, I can watch episode 8, and I can watch episode 2. And it had been so many years of serial storytelling, of television bordering on dramas that border on soap opera.
Yeah.
That having something anthology style was just so unusual and refreshing.
Yeah, I not even soap opera, because soap opera has built into it this idea that you want people to be coming in and picking things up. Mm-hmm. As the show is ongoing. A lot of these series are basically 7-year-long novels.
Yes, yes. There's a show that I'm probably going to start watching it, but then I realized it's a 5-season commitment.
Yeah.
And man, it better be really good for me to watch that many episodes of anything. So we'll see.
Yeah, people have, you know, their opinions about Game of Thrones and how mm-hmm. that ended. But I think, aside from that, a large part of the reason that shows like Game of Thrones and Lost have so quickly just sort of dropped out of our consciousness once they've finished is there isn't that sense of just, you know, dropping back in to watch an episode. Or mm-hmm. you know, picking it up again just to watch one of the good ones, because it's all this one massive thing.
That's so true. But I can dip into Next Generation. Even though Deep Space Nine does have very long story arcs, there's many, many episodes and many seasons that you can just dip into and watch your favorite episode, and you won't feel like you don't know what's going on.
Exactly. And yeah, with Star Trek, it's always mm-hmm. whichever episode you pick up, if you've never seen Star Trek before, it will take you no time at all to figure out this guy's the captain, this guy's got pointy mm-hmm. ears, they're in a spaceship, and now there's a giant green hand.
Right. And this character is, you know, serves this purpose on the ship, and, you know, this person. You know, you'll even pick up very, very quickly, hey, that person on the away team didn't even get a name.
Yeah.
And you'll pick up on that very, very quickly.
And the dynamic between Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, obviously,
yes.
is
yes.
just a straight-up argument. And it takes you no time mm-hmm. to figure out, okay, this is the person with the homespun wisdom who's going to be making the emotive case. This guy's the cold-hearted but strangely insightful logical computer, and this guy is the hero guy who's gonna make the decision
and also gonna make some impulsive decisions too.
Well, yeah, and I think that's the thing about Kirk that I think has been sort of changed by fandom over the years, because I think we have this idea of him as this sort of Han Solo-ish renegade badass these days. Mm-hmm. But if you watch the original series, he's a massive nerd. Every historical character, every professor they went into, he's like, ah, yes, I'm very familiar with your work. He's a massive stickler for regulations. It's only once you get to the movies he starts getting, you know, kicking against that. Kirk is a great big nerd. He has like 2 serious love affairs and then occasionally flirts to try and get what he wants. He holds sleeping with everyone thing. That's not in the original series.
I really can't wait to tweet the tagline for this episode is going to be Kirk was a nerd.
Absolutely was. But yeah, that's drifting off slightly, but it's a pet thing of mine is the way idea of what the character Kirk is different from the character William Shatner's playing throughout those episodes.
Yes. Thanks for listening to Retro Rockets. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. Our guest today is Chris Farnell. Did you know? You can hear this and other episodes at retrorocketspodcast.podbean.com. We're also on Twitter at retrorocketspod. Show notes and more episode information can also be found at retrorocketspodcast.wordpress.com. I'm with you. I could talk about Star Trek forever, but we talked about some other items. We were talking about a bunch of Stanislaw Lem over email and some other slightly more obscure Planet of the Week style stories.
Yeah, Stanislaw Lem is brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, we say Planet of the Week because we're talking about this sort of TV format, but really what I'm talking about stories where the plot is land on an alien planet, figure out what's weird about this alien planet. And Lem was just fantastic at that. In its more sort of serious mode, you've got The Invincible, which I don't know if have you read The Invincible?
I'm not familiar with that one.
It's as straight up a weird alien planet story as you could want. There's a spaceship that's gone missing. This spaceship has come after it to find out what happened to it. It lands, and as they explore, they find there are a lot of very strange robotic creatures on the planet. There's no other
life. I maybe have read this. Is this in Star Diaries?
No, it's Star Diaries. I know the one you're thinking of, but this is...
Okay, so I'm thinking of a different one. All right.
Yeah. Now, this is, without wanting to give too much away it's very much about just trying to figure out how and why this machine ecosystem has come to exist at the expense of any other kind of life.
Tell me more.
Well, it basically comes down to that there have been machines on the planet, but they're self-repairing machines and self-constructing machines, and so they have stumbled onto their own Darwinism, basically. And it has led to an entire planet of evolved machine life. But what's great about it is there's no sense that these are, you know, evil robots or a Terminator rebellion or even AI in the sense that you'd normally understand it. It's just a story about the process of natural selection and what that does. And from that, it just becomes this really... challenge to the whole idea of space exploration, the whole idea that humans have a right to just go out and land on planets and figure out why they work or make them their own. And it's one of the best sci-fi stories I've read in that vein. There's actually, I think, next year, possibly later, there's a video game adaptation coming out of it where they've done it with very sort of Soviet punk kind of technology. It's a sort of big open world exploration game.
I am absolutely fascinated by the concept of robots who, you know, had to have been programmed or created once upon a time by someone who's not a robot, figuring out evolution and their own version of natural selection.
Well, yeah, and it's what's great is there's no is it's an incredibly blind process. It's just this works. We will keep doing this. This doesn't work. So that stops. And from that, you get complexity.
I was an idiot a few minutes ago, and I did not write down the name of that story. Can you tell me the name of it again?
It's The Invincible.
The Invincible. Well, I know what I'm looking up later today.
Yeah, no, the one you were thinking of, The Star Diaries.
Yes!
That's... Yeah, you're thinking of the planet of robots that are incredibly xenophobic to humans, aren't you?
Yes, it's we keep sending people, and you know the person's last message will always be something along the lines of "I'm landing on the planet. I'll talk to you soon," and they're never ever heard from again. So, I have a confession. I don't know how to pronounce the character's name.
I was looking it up before I came on here.
Okay.
But I may have forgotten it already. Let's see. Ijon Tihi.
Tihi, that's how it's pronounced.
I think so. I listened to the pronunciation video a few times before I came on.
All right.
Yes.
So of course, you know, Tihi, because he just has all the crazy adventures. Either he volunteers to go to the planet or, you know, he's voluntold to go. And if I remember correctly, it's been a handful of years since I read this. If I remember correctly, the plan for him to still be able to stay in touch is like he's going to wear basically a robot costume.
Yes.
And it's uncomfortable, and it makes his shoulders hurt, and but he doesn't want to expose, and you know that he's a human, so he pretends that he's a robot, and it kind of reminds me of that one Futurama episode where Fry is convinced that he's a robot,
100%.
Right? Yes.
Yeah.
And I remember reading this story and just laughing my head off, and I'm reading it. And I've read it a handful of times, but the first time I had no idea what was going to happen. I had no idea where the plot was going. And I get to the end, and of course I'm not going to say what happens, but I just absolutely, my mind was blown, and I didn't know if I should be screaming or if I should be laughing or if I should be crying.
Yeah.
But fantastic story.
But also in as a metaphor as well, it's brilliant. You've got someone who's writing, you know, under the pressure of, you know, Stalinist state censorship, and you've got
that's where the screaming and crying reaction came from.
And you've got this person who is trapped in a robot costume, has to act and do everything a robot does, surrounded by robots.
Right.
And then there's the rest of the metaphor, which we won't talk about here, but it's brilliant. Mm-hmm. And I think all the Star Diary stories work so well on that level. You've got the one where it's a planet of clones, and every day everyone's job is just switched randomly.
Yes. Oh, And those stories too, they're episodic. You know, certainly characters will reference things that happened in other stories, but I can guarantee that whatever little short story collection I read them in, whatever order they were presented was certainly not the order they were chronologically published in. So they're a perfect example of, you know, adventure of the week. You can read them in any order. You can just jump in anywhere and pick up very, very quickly as to what's going on and have a great time.
Exactly. And each one is just a different idea being played with. Mm-hmm. And also, mm-hmm. just he's writing Douglas Adams about a decade or so before Douglas Adams.
Yes.
It's just fantastic. I think Douglas Adams, you know, pretty much owns the entire sci-fi comedy genre for a reason, but mm-hmm. it is astounding that Stanislaw Lem is not up there with it.
I know. Lem is just an absolute genius at taking a small idea, something you can explain in a sentence, and running with it.
Yeah.
In a way that I've not seen many other authors do to that extent.
Yeah, and I think that's what you come to science fiction for, is to get that sense mm-hmm. of starting with a thought experiment and then colouring it in and filling out the details and actually mm-hmm. trying to look at what a world like that would be like.
Yes, yes. I want to, I need to change topics just a little bit here, because I did have a bit of an ulterior motive bringing you on Retro Rockets. I want to hear, well, you teased me, and now I'm totally going to put you on the spot. Tell me everything about Fermi's Paradox.
Fermi's Paradox, the why are we alone in the universe? Where is everybody? Question.
Mm-hmm. And your novella series around that.
Yes. Well, the name of the series is Fermi's Progress, which is a riffing off that, because Fermi's Paradox is the question of where are all the aliens. And the Fermi, the prototype fast-than-light ship in these stories, blows up every planet of aliens it encounters. So, sort of answers the question. But yeah, it's basically, like we've been talking about, this idea of wanting stories where you can just have a world, have an idea, pick it up, play with it. And I was getting a bit frustrated with all of the sort of very serialized and expanded universe science fiction that we have, where you wanted those sort of old stories where it seemed like after Kirk beamed up and the Enterprise flew away, the planet might as well just have exploded when they left.
Oh, that's true, because no one ever mentioned it again.
Exactly. So I just thought, okay, why not? So Fermi's Progress is made up of four novellas. It's all available in one paperback volume now, or we'll do plugging later. But it's basically four stories. In each story, the Fermi arrives at a planet, has an adventure, leaves. Nobody knows why the fast-than-light drive keeps blowing up every planet it encounters. Nobody knows why they seem to keep turning up on planets with intelligent life either. But they can't turn the engine off, and they can't control where they're going.
Do they? But they sort of know what's going on. Like, they know that the ship is going to take them somewhere. And they know that the engines of the ship will destroy the planet as they're leaving. Do the people that live on the planet ever get a warning or anything?
Oh, well, that would be giving away some of the plots of some of the stories, but it was a prototype ship, so basically hammered together from all of the leftovers of Cold War science and experimental science, and it was left floating in orbit for 20 years, and then our crew board it and try it out, and then discover that it, as well as going faster than light, also blows the Earth up.
Oh my gosh.
And then they find themselves at another planet. And, well, another world. And not long after they arrive there, they realise that the engine is powering up and they don't know how to switch it off. And they very quickly figure out what's going to happen to that world as well. And by the time they get to the third planet, they've, you know, started to get into a bit of a rhythm with things. And generally, when you land on an alien planet that you're about to vaporise, it's not good to lead with that.
That's true.
But each story is basically a chance to pick up an idea and just, you know, make it go vroom, see what you can do with it, and then, you know, when you're finished with it, blow it up. So there's a Dyson sphere, and there is a planet of sentient mushrooms in the middle of a strange kind of zombie apocalypse. And there's a massive floating beehive in the atmosphere of a gas giant, among other things. And it's just a great sandbox to play in.
I want to visit all of those places, like not minus the zombie apocalypse. Sentient mushrooms sound awesome. A flying beehive in a gas giant sounds like a whole ton of fun. If I could visit those places without having to blow them up afterwards so that they could keep on doing their thing, I would be the happiest space traveler ever. So you've written 4 novellas in the series. Do you have plans for more?
There's more being written at the moment. Yeah, there's an arc planned out. I'm currently writing the second novella of the next sort of little cycle of stories.
Fantastic. So as we wrap up, where can our listeners find you online? Do you have a website? Are you on Twitter? Are you on any other social media?
You can find me at chrisfarnell.com and on Twitter at The Brain of Chris. Fermi's Progress, you can get either separately or all together in paperback at Amazon, or, and this is my preferred method for people to buy it, you can go to Scarlet Ferret, which is an independent online ebook store. And if you buy it there, it comes with a lot of bonus extras. Not coincidentally, the author gets a bigger share of the royalties. And you're not giving any money to Jeff Bezos, which I'm always in favor of when it's an option.
Tell us that website again for not Amazon.
That is Scarlet Ferret.
Fantastic. Chris, thank you so, so much for being my guest today. This has been such a great conversation.
Thank you. I've had a great time.
The Retro Rockets podcast explores the deep heritage of vintage and classic science fiction and fantasy. I'm your host, Andrea Johnson. Our show is recorded, mixed, and produced by Andy Robbins. John Wenger is our special consultant. Our music is by Meter through a Creative Commons license, and Carolyn Baker designed our logo. Thanks for listening, and join us again next time on Retro Rockets. Thank you.